Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. There is continued discussion and controversy over the St. Louis County Grand Jury's decision not to indict former Ferguson police officer Darren Wilson in the shooting death of Michael Brown. Our legal roundtable panel will look at it from several angles on today's program. The U.S. Supreme Court has decided it will take on same-sex marriage this term. It'll be a landmark decision when it rules. And Larry Flint, the publisher of Hustler magazine, takes on Missouri's execution protocol. I'm Don Marsh, joined today by attorneys Mark Smith, Associate Vice Chancellor at Washington University and Director of the Career Center there. Bill Freivogel is Professor of Journalism at Southern Illinois University at Carbondale. And Susan Appleton, Professor of Law at Washington University. Thank you all so much for being with us.
Good morning.
Susan, good to have you.
Thank you for inviting me.
Our rookie member.
Yes.
Your specialty is family law, so I'm going to start with you. Put you
Great.
In the hot seat right away. I'd like to start with the same-sex marriage. I think a lot of people thought that the Supreme Court might punt on this issue, but it didn't.
Well, it was able to avoid the issue when U.S. courts of appeals were uniformly all ruling the same way, striking down restrictions on same-sex marriage or on recognition of marriages celebrated in other states. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit recently ruled the other way in a 2-1 opinion, upholding in a set of 4 different cases restrictions on marriage or on marriage recognition for same-sex couples. The opinion's pretty amazing because the judge is writes it in a very low-key, progressive way, says this is just about change and the best way to make change. He's embracing change, but decides that it's better for the legislative process and the people to do it rather than the courts.
Do we have any hints, Bill Freivogel, from the court itself on how it might go?
Well, I don't know exactly if we have hints. I mean, I think it comes down very possibly, as many of these things do, to Justice Kennedy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in his opinion, I guess it's now two Junes ago, striking down the Defense of Marriage Act, he sort of based that on two considerations that actually look opposite directions. One was on that the states have traditionally been able to decide who gets married, sort of a states' rights almost approach, a federalism, dual federalism approach. And then on the other hand, also an individual liberty approach of that states shouldn't be able to discriminate against people based upon their lifestyle. He was particularly concerned, both in that oral argument and there's mention of this in the decision, about the children of same-sex couples, and that they would be treated, that they should not face any kind of a stigma, that they would if their parents' marriage was declared by the state to be illegitimate. So I say those things point in different directions because, you know, on the one hand, if you take the states' rights approach, you could say, well, it's up to the states to decide whether or not they're going to permit same-sex marriages. If you take the more individual liberty, anti-discrimination kind of approach, then you can't really allow a state to discriminate against a particular kind of marriage.
So some people have seen some hints in the very careful way that the court framed the questions it would address. So it doesn't talk about a right to marriage or even discrimination per se, but rather the court said it would answer 2 questions. Does the 14th Amendment require a state to license a marriage between 2 people of the same sex? And then does the 14th Amendment require a state to recognize a marriage between 2 people of the same sex that was lawfully licensed and celebrated out of state? So it's what is required of the state. And some people have interpreted that to suggest something somewhat narrow or perhaps some sort of escape valve for the court if it doesn't decide to be completely bold here.
So they could try to split the thing again by mm-hmm. saying states have to recognize same-sex marriages performed legally in other states, but they don't have to permit them to be performed in their own state.
Mark, what's your take on it?
Well, I agree with exactly what they said. I mean, I think kind of stepping back from this case, just looking at the line of cases, I mean, the Bauer versus Hardwick case, that was like 1986. I think that was when I was graduating from law school. not that long ago, and the Supreme Court said, upheld as constitutional law, making sexual homosexual activity a crime. I mean, that's a pretty big jump to make in this short period of time, and I think it reflects what's going on in the society, but also the Supreme Court moving probably pretty quickly on a big issue like this.
Mark, 1986 was a long time ago.
Not that long. I mean, but the Supreme Court, no, you're right, it is a long time, but the Supreme Court moves at a glacial pace. I mean, they don't make big changes typically.
But there was Lawrence in 2003
that's
that
exactly
struck
right.
down, reversed Bowers. And then there was Windsor in 2013.
So they've been chipping away at it, right.
Mm-hmm. And it's significant that Justice Kennedy wrote both of those decisions.
And Romer v. Evans, which was an anti-discrimination case involving gays and lesbians.
We, of course, can't get into the minds of Supreme Court justices until they issue their rulings and explain how they're thinking. But we're all agreed, I think, that there is obviously a national momentum toward same-sex marriage. 37 states now have approved it. Does that sort of thing, do you think, influence the Supreme Court?
Well, that's exactly what the judge who wrote the Sixth Circuit opinion said is the reason for the courts not to get involved, that this is happening anyway, and it doesn't require judicial intervention, though a number of the states that now do allow gay marriage have done so because of judicial decisions. But some of them have done it legislatively, and he thinks that this shows that change is on the way, no matter what the courts mm-hmm. might do. So that could cut in either direction.
And another harbinger of change to come, I find this kind of interesting, is Scalia, who dissented in some of these other cases, saying and kind of doing his, you know, he's sarcastic. We might get to that later. But one of the things he said, if you do this, then you're going to have to do this in the future. And then lower courts have said, well, Scalia says we have to do it. So it's pushed forward in the yes. opposite direction that he wanted.
In Windsor, even though the issue before the court was not the validity yeah. of state laws, he took an excerpt from the majority's opinion and simply changed a few words to show how the majority had provided a template for federal courts to strike down state marriage restrictions.
Of course, a lot of these 37 states that now permit same-sex marriage are doing so because they're required to by
yeah.
by court decision.
Court, yeah.
So it's not as if those states have actually themselves approved those. But it sure would be a real undoing of like a new reality if the court were to say were to stop short
right.
of saying that states have to permit same-sex marriages.
Well, what would happen to someplace like Missouri where we've just gone through this if, in fact, they did that? I mean, what would happen to these
well,
marriages?
Well, there are challenges. I mean, the Missouri yeah. Supreme Court's got a case. The Eighth Circuit's got a case. Marriages have been celebrated in St. Louis. It's not clear. The middle ground that Bill mentioned is for the court to rule that marriages validly celebrated in other states need to be recognized throughout the United States, but that no state has to license or perform such marriages themselves. Now, that puts the burden of travel on couples who have to find a place where they can go. So it's not full equality, but it does allow some opportunity to have access to marriage and its benefits for everyone.
So if the Supreme Court were to take that approach, then you would probably have couples. I mean, so Missouri would have to recognize Illinois couples moving, or Iowa couples moving to Missouri, recognize their same-sex marriages, but wouldn't have to recognize a St. Louisan who wanted to get two St. Louisans who wanted to get married. So I think you'd have a lot of...
Except unless those St. Louisans just went to Iowa for the sole purpose of getting married.
That's what I was just going to say. You just would have I think you'd have a big stream of people going across state borders, getting married, coming back and saying, hey, you got to recognize
our
marriage.
And in fact, in some of the cases that are part of this Sixth Circuit set, that's exactly what happened. In one case, there were two men, one of whom was dying of ALS. They flew to Maryland, got married on a specially medically equipped jet that would allow the ill partner to go. They came back to Ohio and asked to have that marriage recognized so that when the one died, he could be listed as the spouse, and ultimately the other one, when he finally dies probably years later, will be able to be buried next to him. So we've already seen people go out of state for that purpose.
But it creates problems beyond just this travel. I think we talked about this maybe last month that, you know, in some states, if you want to get a divorce, so say Missouri doesn't allow it, so I have to go to Illinois, I get married there, and then I want to get divorced 7 years later. Well, Missouri won't do it because they didn't do the marriage. And then some of these states require like a year of residency before you grant a divorce. So it's really, I mean, this middle ground would not be a good solution.
It sounds like the court could make the situation much more complicated than it is already.
Yeah, they could. You know, one thing I think that makes one think that at least one of these cases, the Michigan case, is sort of right. It's a perfect case for Kennedy to say that you can't have an in-state ban on gay marriage, and that it involves two nurses who have been raising four adopted children who are abandoned by their own mothers. And the judge, I guess, in that case said he just could not justify declaring that marriage not to be permissible.
Well, I think they actually originally filed simply to adopt one another's adopted children so that the children would have two parents. And the court said, you can't do that, but why don't you ask to get married? And that's how the case became a marriage equality case.
Is it possible that this same-sex marriage issue could turn on children? Susan, you mentioned early on that this was one of the questions that was asked earlier. Could, and you're nodding in the affirmative.
Oh, yes. And in fact, there's a famous passage in Justice Kennedy's opinion in Windsor about how this two-track system of federal marriage law, that is the fact that under DOMA, the feds would not recognize same-sex marriages even validly celebrated in the state, that it humiliates thousands of children. And that seems to be the linchpin of a number of these other cases that have gone the same way. And we do have a long history of protecting children from being discriminated against in constitutional law for the sins of their parents. The Supreme Court got rid of many classifications that punished illegitimate children simply because they were born outside marriage. It wasn't the child's fault.
Well, I guess by June or in June, most likely, we'll get this thing resolved one way or the other.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to take a break. We'll come back. And when we do, we'll talk about the Ferguson fallout and other things. My guests in studio, you just heard from Susan Appleton, who is a law professor at Washington University. Mark Smith, also from Washington University, is with us as part of our Legal Roundtable panel, as is Bill Freivogel. We'll come back and continue the conversation in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back to our Legal Roundtable panel discussion. Before we turn to the Ferguson story, I want to just hit on another couple of Supreme Court issues. Bill Freivogel, I'll turn to you for this. One concerns judicial campaign spending, and the other involves a couple of criminal cases. The criminal campaign spending thing has shades of Citizens United painted around it somehow.
Right. But once again, we come back to Justice Kennedy, I think. So the Citizens United was at very controversial decision saying that corporations and labor unions can use unlimited funds to try to elect candidates. And so there has been a 5-justice majority on the Supreme Court. All these cases have been 5-4. 5-justice majority on the Supreme Court saying that regulations of campaign finance oftentimes will conflict with the First Amendment. And Justice Kennedy wrote a lot of those decisions. So he is required for the majority in this case. Well, Justice Kennedy also happens to care a lot about the judiciary appearing to be impartial. So if there's a campaign finance case where he's more likely to switch sides, this is it. And he did ask some questions yesterday that made it appear as though that might be true. 39 states have restrictions on judges. This case involves bar restrictions on judges soliciting contributions from people who might – lawyers who might appear before them in court.
This would have more relevance in Illinois, actually, than it would in Missouri, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Well, so both Missouri and Illinois have laws. 30 of 39 there are 39 states that elect some or all of their judges, including Illinois and Missouri, and 30 of them have some form of personal solicitation ban. Missouri bars a judge from personally – soliciting a person who might appear before the court, but permits the judge to write a letter. Illinois doesn't permit either. So, yes, I think it could potentially affect both states, depending on how the decision comes down.
And in this Florida case, Florida says the judge has to have a separate committee that does any kind of solicitation. And in this case, the judge wrote a letter asking for money. And so Florida bar sanctioned her. But I think this all happened before Citizens United, but it's now making its way to the United States Supreme Court because she's saying, no, under Citizens United, I have the right to do that. So this bar restriction is unconstitutional.
Is it her right to get the funds, or is it the right of the donors to contribute?
It's her right to solicit.
Okay.
That she has a right to solicit. Right.
And Susan, family law is your specialty. Once corporations were deemed to be people, have you folded that into your curriculum?
Not yet.
Back to the other Supreme Court issue, and that is a couple of criminal cases, one of which involves Missouri, Bill Freiwald.
Well, yes. Yesterday the Supreme Court issued what's called a per curiam opinion, which means they made the decision without having their normal oral arguments. This involved a death row inmate from Missouri. His name is Christensen. He's convicted of, I believe it's a triple murder.
Yes.
He also has apparently very limited cognitive abilities. But what the case involved was whether or not his lawyers had let him down. The federal law says you get to have a lawyer represent you in a death penalty case if you're on death row. But they say they have a one-year statute of limitations. You got to file a habeas corpus claim within 1 year. The two lawyers who represented Christensen didn't. They didn't even meet with him until after the year was over. So both all the lower courts, including the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals, the appeals court here, said tough luck. And he was actually very close to being executed last fall before the court issued a stay. And now what the court has said is this fellow should get a chance with a good lawyer who actually will meet with him and argue his case, should get a chance to claim that he shouldn't be bound by that one-year statute of limitation.
And I thought that part of their reasoning was that the attorneys who let him down had a conflict of interest, that they don't want to bow out of the case and be substituted by the other attorneys.
Because it would damage their reputation.
Right. Yes, and that because they have their professional reputations at stake, the substitution is proper. They couldn't possibly be expected to make the strongest arguments for why he was not well represented.
The strongest argument being I'm incompetent, basically, which is what you'd have to argue. And and apparently they're also refusing to give files to the new lawyers. Lawyers is some St. Louis U law faculty, right?
There were some folks in the middle who were lawyers from the East Coast, Philadelphia maybe. And actually the courts here said, well, we don't have to let out-of-state lawyers represent, even though the out-of-state lawyers said, hey, we won't even charge you for our travel back and forth.
And I think they're death penalty experts.
Well, if the original lawyers blew it, and I think that's the term that I read that happened, is there any punitive action that would be taken against them for, regardless of their personal
reputations? Somebody could bring an ethics charge against them. I mean, they missed a deadline. I'm not minimizing that, but I suspect many lawyers have missed deadlines from time to time.
I think they missed it by a long time.
Like 100 days
like Bill
or something
said,
like
I think
that.
They were assigned. I think they were assigned somewhere within the one-year period. Yeah, they appointed a year into it, but they were paid. Mm-hmm. And then they met with them like 6 months later after the deadline had passed. But I think there would be – that's probably an ethical violation.
The lawyers were Eric Butts and Phil Horwitz. And so they were 117 days late filing this petition. And then later on, when their record after that is sort of mixed. But, as Mark was saying, they weren't turning over the case files, and they weren't entirely they were sort of standing in the way. As a matter of fact, they claimed that Christensen's argument was ludicrous. That was their term, ludicrous, to suggest that he should have a chance to stay alive.
Susan, what would you tell your law students about the performance of these attorneys?
I'd say that it was not up to par and that didn't do their job well. And I think, you know, this may show the difficulty of some of these appointments in these cases.
Yeah. One might even say their behavior was ludicrous.
Mm-hmm.
All right. One might say that. All right. The other case for the court, and then we'll have to move on, concerns the inmate in Arkansas who wanted to grow a beard, and the authorities there said you can't do that because you could hide contraband in your beard. I think it was a half-inch beard or something.
Beard. Right? Yeah. Or also you could disguise yourself. That you, right. If the only picture they had was you in a beard, and then you escape, you could shave it off, and they wouldn't be able to recognize
you. Well, of course, they take inmates' pictures with and without the beard. So that wasn't a very good argument. Plus, the court was not very persuaded that that you could hide a lot of contraband in a half-inch beard. Interestingly, this is based upon, partly, the decision is based upon the Hobby Lobby decision of last year. So it's the religious freedom of this. Of this inmate, and you know, once he shows that he really has a serious religious tenet that's being violated, then the government has to show it's the least restrictive. Its rules are the least restrictive way to achieve their goal of, you know, a safe prison. In this case, and they weren't able to do that.
The court ruled in favor of the inmate,
right?
And the court basically said, you know. He could let his hair grow long. He could hide contraband there. He wears clothes. Contraband could be hidden there. So what's
I think they even cited that there are a number of other prison systems in which beards are allowed, and those aren't any less secure than.
I think the federal prison system allows for that.
I think historically, though, I mean, prisons had always been given a lot of discretion. Right. And I think these guys went in thinking this is a no-brainer. Of course, we're a prison. We get to do whatever we want. And I mean, because they didn't have very good reasons, and maybe there aren't any good reasons, but they just kind of went in with, like you said, well, he might disguise himself, but yeah, take two pictures. It's not that hard.
The other thing that we didn't see here, though, that came up in the oral arguments, I recall, was Justice Scalia's questions about the fact that his religion actually wouldn't allow him to trim his beard at all. And that he was willing to make a compromise. And I think Scalia had some concern that the compromise cast some doubt on
the sincerely held belief.
Yes.
Right.
But the court just glossed over that and took the claim as it was made.
There was one paragraph that Justices Sotomayor and Ginsburg wrote saying, hey, even though we're all unanimous here, this is not the same as Hobby Lobby. Hobby Lobby affected lots of other, you know, the religious accommodation there ended up affecting a lot of women who were trying to seek contraceptive support, and this didn't affect any other people.
I'm going to turn now to the Ferguson story because we have a guest online. We're going to be joined for a few minutes by senior NAACP Legal Defense Fund counsel Vincent Sutherland, who is on the line. Mr. Sutherland, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Todd.
Just bring us up to speed on what it is that the Defense Fund is seeking and where you are in your whole process of your investigation of the Ferguson grand jury.
Sure. So what the Legal Defense Fund did was back on January 5th, we submitted a letter to the presiding judge of the 21st Judicial Circuit Court in St. Louis County. And basically what we were seeking was ways in which to restore integrity and fairness to this process. Our review of the grand jury transcripts, which were released by Mr. McCulloch's office, and with the assistance of Missouri lawyers and lawyers across the country, looking at these transcripts revealed a number of irregularities and concerns about the way in which the proceedings were conducted, from Mr. McCulloch's admitted presentation of evidence that he knew was false to instructions to the grand jurors that were riddled with concerning errors, to their encouragement of behavior on the part of the individual grand jurors that would fall outside the confines of what a judge actually ordered them to do, which was not conduct their own investigation of the case. And so what we really sought was for the presiding judge of St. Louis County Circuit Court to take a look at these proceedings and investigate them, and if if the investigation revealed those types of concerns that we had raised in our letter, to appoint a special prosecutor to take remedial action in this particular case.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, go ahead, go ahead.
I was just going to ask what the response has been. I know you've just received word from them.
So we did receive response from the Director of Judicial Administration for the St. Louis County Circuit Court, and that response really really focused on the Code of Judicial Conduct to prohibit the judge from permitting ex parte communications about a matter or a pending matter or an impending matter that may come before the court. And so the judge did not respond to us directly, but rather the court administrator did. And what we did in response to that letter was actually seek further clarification of what pending matter or impending matter the court was referencing that would make this our communication an ex parte communication that would possibly violate the Code of Judicial Conduct. And so we're seeking further clarification from the court regarding their response, and hopefully we'll follow up in turn once we get that clarification.
There are a number of other individuals and organizations that are seeking essentially the same sort of thing that you are. There's an ethics project here in Missouri which has filed a similar complaint. Four separate activists have gotten into it. There's an individual grand juror who basically wants some more information released on all of this. Are you coordinating at all with any of these people or these entities?
Well, you know, we've certainly been in touch with all these entities and worked with all these entities at one point or another over the course of our work in Ferguson. And one of the things that we want to be sure that we do and what we've always done in the past is make sure that the voices of local advocates and local lawyers and the community who is most harmed and most affected by these issues plays a prominent and dominant role in the conversation. And so we continue to support those efforts by the Ferguson Legal Defense Committee and local Missouri lawyers, by the Ethics Project and by the ACLU of Missouri, all raising and drawing attention to the integrity of this grand jury process and really raising some serious questions along the lines that we had about all that happened during the proceedings to try and indict Officer Wilson.
Well, let me assure you, if you don't know it already, and I'm sure you do, that there are plenty of people here who are watching this part of it because there are so many folks who are involved with these kinds of complaints. So if I understand correctly, what you've done is respond to the response you received yesterday. So the next step, I suppose, is waiting for a response from the county judge.
That's correct, yes. We got our response last week. We sent a letter back and followed up with a phone call to try and get a response from the Director of Judicial Administration. And once we receive that response, we'll kind of act accordingly. But in the meantime, and I'm sure this will be true going forward, we'll continue to support the efforts of local advocates and local partners who are raising these very same issues and very same concerns with the grand jury proceedings.
I have three attorneys with me here for this program. I think, Bill, did you have a question you wanted to put to him?
Yes, I have a question. Good morning. Do you know of any, is there any precedent for what you're asking the judge to do, either in Missouri or elsewhere, where a grand jury has declined to indict the prosecutor who was in charge of the grand jury? Has moved forward and announced that no true bill has no difficulties with the decision of the grand jury. Do you know of any case where a judge then has said, "Well, we're going to start this over, have a special prosecutor and a new grand jury"?
Well, there certainly have been cases in Missouri, older cases in Missouri, where there was a finding that the prosecutor who was involved in the particular prosecution of a case had some type of an interest or a bias in that particular matter, and therefore refused to prosecute the case in the manner in which they should proceed. And in that point, the court stepped in, appointed a special prosecutor, and moved forward in that matter and convened in the grand jury, and the proceedings kind of took place going forward after that. But, you know, part of the concern here is that what happened in this particular case really seems, in many ways, unprecedented. You have the chief law enforcement officer basically saying that he knowingly presented testimony of witnesses who he knew were lying before the grand jury, and allowing that testimony to proceed and infect the process. And so those types of concerns really raise kind of unprecedented levels of concerns regarding this process and call for measures that, while they may not be the most popular it may not have taken place, in a significant number of cases, really should be able to meet the concerns that are raised in this particular case.
Unless some of my colleagues here at the table have a question for you, Sarah, I'm going to thank you so much for being with us and bringing us up to speed on what the NAACP Legal Defense Fund is doing in this Ferguson matter. Thank you so much, Vincent Sutherland.
Thanks so much for having me. Take good care.
Keep us posted on what's going on. I'm sure we'll be hearing about it.
Definitely will.
That is Vincent Sutherland from the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. He's the he is the counsel for that organization. What do you think? There's so much going on with this. It's really hard to separate all of the different things that are taking place. So
I think the other issue, and I think you've talked about it on this show before with another guest, is the confusion in the instructions of law that were given to the grand jury. And I don't know if his if that's included.
That's part of their what they're they were first given the wrong instruction and that was corrected later. That created problems.
There
for the grand jury.
Seem to be so many facets to this with regard to that. I wonder if releasing the transcript was really a good idea from the prosecutor's point of view.
Yeah, he may wish he hadn't done that. Yeah. But I think that releasing the transcript, I mean, he promised to be as transparent as he could be, given the fact that grand juries are not transparent. They're a secret. And so by releasing the transcript, I think he did achieve that. You know, that goal of his and that promise of his. He certainly has suffered. He may not want to go on a lot of TV, radio talk shows either, because, you know, the thing about having permitted perjured testimony to be presented without remedying it grows out of an interview he had with, I think, McGraw-Milhaven, in which he said that he knew that Witness 40, who was a sort of unusual witness, was clearly lying. Now, they had presented to the grand jury, I think even maybe before she testified, they had presented to the grand jury that FBI, I think maybe video or audio of recordings of interviews with Witness 40 with the FBI that made it clear that the FBI and U.S. attorneys didn't believe her. So I think maybe McCullough would say, well, so that's how we remedied that. And he also indicated that there were other witnesses he thought weren't telling the truth.
One thing I'm not clear on with regard to grand jury number 40 and that in the lying aspect of this, did they know before the grand jury, before the testimony was given, that it was false, or was that only determined once as it was being given?
I think they knew that her general story was, that corroborated Wilson's account that was probably false because she couldn't have been where she said she was and probably wasn't there at all.
I think I referred to grand juror number 40. Is that witness number
40? Witness number 40. Yeah. I may have done the same thing.
Yeah. There's a bunch of different things. There's this request for a new grand jury. I mean, personally, I don't see that going anywhere. I just think that would be the case that your caller identified. That was a very different set of facts. So I think that's going to be tough. I think the ethics complaint is going to be very tough. What I find kind of interesting is this grand juror who wants to be able to come forward and tell his or her story. I think that one could win, and I think that could be very interesting.
I want to pick up on that point. We have to take another break. We'll do that now. Bill Freivogel has written on that, and we'll undoubtedly have some comment on it. We'll be back in just a moment to continue our legal roundtable discussion. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back to our legal roundtable panel discussion. Before we continue that discussion, here are some of the stories our St. Louis Public Radio newsroom is following today. Democratic Missouri Governor Jay Nixon plans to call for increased education funding and bipartisan cooperation as he delivers his annual State of the State address to the legislature tonight. The governor will outline his budget priorities as part of his seventh annual speech to a joint session of the House and Senate, which has some of its largest Republican ranks in decades. St. Louis Public Radio will carry the address live at 7 o'clock this evening. Proposed legislation that would lower the amount of revenue cities can raise from traffic fines will get its first hearing in the state legislature this afternoon. The issue has been raised since Michael Brown's fatal shooting by a Ferguson police officer last summer. Bill's sponsor, Eric Schmidt, says municipalities should only be allowed to fund 10% of their budgets from traffic tickets. And a Cole County judge will hear arguments today from two media organizations about the secrecy of the state of Missouri's execution protocol. The plaintiffs, including St. Louis Public Radio, want the Missouri Department of Corrections to release information about the drugs that are used when carrying out the death penalty. You can learn more about these and other stories this afternoon on St. Louis Public Radio and throughout the day at stlpublicradio.org. Now back to our panelists for this legal roundtable panel discussion, Mark Smith, Bill Freivogel, and Susan Appleton. Back now with the Ferguson thing before we move on to other stories. Bill, I'll turn to you once again for the grand juror who wants to be heard. You have written about this and say that this attempt has legs.
Well, I think that's what my legal friends tell me, that there was a Supreme Court case in which a grand jury witness was being barred from writing and talking about what the witness had testified to. Now, that's different than a grand juror, but it's the Supreme Court did say, and this was actually Chief Justice Rehnquist, no huge friend of the First Amendment, who said it, that you couldn't have just a very broad, total blackout of allow a grand jury, barring a grand jury witness from testifying. Now, in that case, it actually was a newspaper reporter who was called to testify about something he was researching, and that he wanted to write a book about and write newspaper stories about. So he had an especially good reason to want to be able to communicate mm-hmm. about the same topics he testified about. I don't know if this grand juror can make that strong case, although what the grand juror says is that McCullough has mischaracterized the case and sort of indicated that there was unanimity amongst the grand juror, the grand jurors, and that this grand anonymous grand juror, I don't think we know if it's a he or a she, also wants to talk about this confusion of what the instruction was on police officers' right to use deadly force.
Susan?
And wouldn't McCullough's professed commitment to transparency in some ways open the door to this?
I think exactly.
He can't have it both ways.
And in fact, in his memorandum in support, because he filed mm-hmm. to get approval, and he talks about how the grand jury secrecy rules are not absolute, that the courts have cut back. So he's kind of laying the groundwork there, I think, and I agree with you. And another thing that this grand juror said is, I'd like to be able to talk to my family about this in the privacy of my home. I mean, imagine, this has got to be a tremendous burden for those people, and you just got to keep it to yourself. You can't talk to anyone about it. Mm-hmm. That just seems very unfair. I'm sure they want to talk to more than just their family. But
when they sign on swearing that they will right. keep it secret. So swearing such a thing is swearing such a thing.
Yeah, and violating that oath would subject the person to, I think it's some sort of a misdemeanor, but it mm-hmm. would be one that
it's
would,
a crime.
It's a crime that for which you could be jailed and have to pay a fine. But I agree with both Susan and Mark that that McCullough's own arguments have sort of opened the door, because he did not want to wait for the judge, Judge Whittington, to open up the grand jury transcripts, so he just did it on his own. But he had a lawyer prepare a memorandum saying the Sunshine Law permits these records to be open. Now, mm-hmm. now that and the ACLU on behalf of this anonymous juror attached that memorandum and said, yeah. "See, look yeah. he said this himself." Of course, if you actually read the memorandum, there is an exception for situations for grand juror votes and grand juror, grand jurors themselves talking.
We have a caller who wants to get into this part of the discussion. Let's bring Tom in. He's calling from South City. Tom, go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you, Don. I really appreciate this conversation with the recent news that there won't be another grand jury. And my question is, this witness 40, was that the only witness who corroborated Wilson's story that Michael Brown rushed at the officer, after he started shooting or whatever, however it goes, with over 1,000 pages of testimony? It's very difficult for the average news consumer to work that out, and I really appreciate being able to ask the experts what they know.
Tom, thanks so much. I think it was 5,000 pages, weren't there?
There were a lot, yes. Yeah. But there really it's premature to say there won't be another grand jury. I mean, I think I think most likely there will not be. Right. If I were a betting man, like Mark, which I'm not, I would bet there will not be another grand jury. But because there's really no precedent for what the Legal Defense Fund is requesting. Of course, you know, let's not forget there could be there is a federal investigation that is still live into this, whether or not Officer Wilson violated the civil rights of Michael Brown. And I'm not sure that we know whether or not there's actually grand jury hearing taking testimony on that, but it would be very possible as to whether or not anyone besides Witness 40, there was other corroboration of some other corroboration of Wilson's account, and there was also some some physical evidence in that Brown had moved back 21 feet in the direction based upon where the blood splatters were found. Brown had moved back 21 feet towards Wilson from his at the time that he actually suffered the fatal shots.
Yeah. The other possible is a civil lawsuit, and we've talked about that before, where the estate of Michael Brown brings an action against a police officer, but you know there would be very broad discovery on both sides, and you know they may try and keep that secret, but that's difficult to do. It'll probably get released.
I want to move on to something else, mm-hmm. but very quickly, using your collective legal wisdom, would you? And I know you know it has a crystal ball, but do you think a special prosecutor could emerge out of all of this?
Honestly, I don't think it's going to happen.
Yeah,
there's really no precedent for it. The four citizens who want to have McCullough removed, they acknowledge that they have to show that the prosecutor acted arbitrarily in bad faith or corruptly. Well, I don't think you can make that case. He exercised his discretion. They may not like the way in which he exercised his discretion, but it's a tougher argument to make that he acted arbitrarily in bad faith or corruptly. Same thing on the legal defense cases that were cited earlier by Mr. Sutherland. Those all involved cases where prosecuting attorneys had conflicts of interest. They had represented somebody before, or they were a witness to the events. There is no Missouri case that I could find or that anyone could point me to that is like this one.
Okay. We'll move along unless someone has something else. I mentioned in the headlines that St. Louis Public Radio is involved in a court proceeding regarding the execution protocol. Let me start this discussion, though, by mentioning the name of Larry Flynt, the Hustler publisher. We've been mentioning it in our headlines earlier today. What in the world is he doing in federal court challenging Missouri's execution protocol?
Well, you know, he was shot by Frank John – is it John? Paul. John Paul Franklin?
Frank, yeah.
The segregationist who a Nazi sympathizer who – is the person who shot Flynt and is, I guess, the reason that Flynt's in a wheelchair.
Right.
Yes. But Flynt said that he thinks the death penalty is not a deterrent. He didn't think that Franklin should be executed. He was. But he has tried to use not only that position, but also the fact that he is the publisher of a magazine to argue that he should be able to get from the state the death penalty protocol, which they've been keeping secret. A lower court judge said that he really didn't have standing to make that case. He just has a general interest in it. He doesn't have a particular standing to request that. Really, maybe. But that was argued before the Court of Appeals last Wednesday, I believe, and they'll probably come up with a decision in several weeks. This Cole County case that you mentioned in the headlines that involves St. Louis Public Radio's Chris McDaniel, that is an argument, again, to release the details of the death penalty protocol in Missouri that have been kept secret, and it's based upon the Sunshine Law. Flynt's thing is based upon the Missouri Sunshine Law. Flynt's case is based on the First Amendment argument. So this will be a real interesting. I think it's 1 p.m. It's right when we get off the air. There'll be this argument in Cole County Circuit Court arguing the Sunshine Law should require the state of Missouri to release the death penalty protocol. The state of Missouri claims it should be secret.
Does St. Louis Public Radio have standing? I mean, is this an issue?
I think no question, but they do.
But I thought I I read that it was the media were simply supporting Flint's claim, not suing on their own.
Right. The media, so there were 14 news organizations that
including the New York Times and Washington Post, real organizations, right?
And maybe St. Louis Post-Dispatch, I'm guessing, because I saw Ben Lippman was one of the lawyers there. But, so 14 news organizations were supporting him. But then the Cole County case is actually the news organizations are the ones that have brought them, from Chris McDaniel to St. Louis Post-Dispatch to The Guardian, the Guardian in England.
And there you have a conflict between the Missouri Sunshine Laws that says things should be public and this kind of I think it's a law that says when we execute someone, we get to keep that private. Although I think part of what's going on, too, is the Missouri, I guess it's Department of Corrections, does these executions, has kind of misled people about what's happening and then been proved wrong. They said we're using drug A and they weren't using drug A. And so the part of what the news organizations are saying in the second case, not the Larry Flint one, is we need to know what's going on here.
And
the
all
public
of this,
has a right to know.
All of this was triggered by McDaniel's reporting early on because of the questions over the drugs that were being used.
Yeah, he was the first. He was out there first. I think his Sunshine Act requests were the first ones that were filed.
All right. Well, we're not going to get a decision in Cole County today. We'll get the
– No.
Yeah, it will probably be some little time. Only a couple of minutes left. I do want to bring up one issue that we had some fun with prior to – going on the air, and that is Justice Scalia's sarcasm. The New York Times did a piece about his ability to be quite sarcastic indeed. Anyone have any comments on what that means, if anything? Mark, I think you were the one who raised it a moment ago.
Well, right. It kind of came and bit him back because the people have been pointing to his sarcasm as saying this is where it goes and to justify where it goes. You know, he came out to WashU Law School, what was that, like 20 years ago or something, and I found him to be a very charming man, although I remember seeing him one-on-one. I remember seeing him in a little interaction with people at the law school, and somebody asked kind of a difficult question, and he really shut him down pretty quickly. So it seems like he's a guy who does this. Do I think it helps him? No. I think it probably polarizes people on the court. And I think that was clear with O'Connor and some of the other ones that he, if you want things, you don't personally attack people. That's not the way to get what you want.
Sounds like the Chris Christie of the Supreme Court.
Yes, I agree with Mark. Justice Scalia can write with a very demeaning style. And that he does in order to show how extreme he thinks his opponents have gone, he actually invites that result. And so in Lawrence versus Texas, he said same-sex marriage will be next. And And in Windsor, he said pretty soon state bans will be, on gay marriage will be struck down. And yes, people read it. His logic that way.
To say that Justice Scalia is sarcastic is to say that the sun rises in the morning and sets in the evening. It's pretty funny that this a social scientist, I guess,
has done
an index of sarcasm, and not surprisingly, Justice Scalia wins. He also makes the Supreme Court a lot more fun. I mean, I bet you if you had another social scientist say, who gets the most laughs and the loudest laughs in the Supreme Court, it would be Justice Scalia. Because he asks funny questions. And
by all accounts, he maintains wonderful personal relationships with his colleagues, even many of whom disagree with him.
Well, Ruth Bader Ginsburg being the classic case. I mean, you'd not put those two together, you wouldn't think, but apparently they're very, very close.
Yeah, last year the two of them had a discussion in front of the National Press Club where they're great friends.
Well, that's good to hear. That's good to hear. So Justice Scalia on the sarcasm index score is very high, or would that be very low? I'm not sure. In any case, that is that for today. I want to thank you all so much for being with us. Productive discussion, I think, on so many interesting issues. Mark Smith, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Will Freivogel, good to see you again. And Susan Appleton, a pleasure to see you. I hope you'll come back.
My pleasure as well.
Now that you know how easy it is, you'll be back to see us, won't you?
Thank you.
That's Susan Appleton of Washington University. Tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, we'll take a look at Missouri Governor Jay Nixon's State of the State Address, which you can hear tonight at 7 o'clock, right here on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.
Archived versions of past St. Louis On the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stopublicradio.org. St. Louis On the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.